I'm Alan, and I'm an alcoholic.
Glad to be here. Glad to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Bob just told me how I ended up speaking at a young people's meeting. It means that I still have growing to do. That's very true. They didn't ask if there's any new people here tonight. Is there anybody here that's less than 30 days sober? All right. I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. I hope that nothing I say here tonight or this afternoon will keep you from coming back again. And I would hope that something that you might hear might give you a spark of hope like it gave to me a long time ago, that life could change, that I didn't have to live the way that I was living and there was another way to do it. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me. It says that we talk about what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. Looking back over my life, my problems began about the time that I could feel or think. It seemed like most of my problems then, and still today, most of the times, my problems seem to be centered in those two areas, either my feelings or my thoughts. And that was at about 3 or 4 years old. I don't know why. I don't know why I felt different than other people. I don't know when I walked up to other kids on the street why I always felt like they were going to turn around and walk the other way. I don't know why in my own family I sat at a dinner table and felt like I was the only one there. I don't know why I always had those feelings. I don't know why I was afraid. I don't know why I felt insecure. I don't know why I felt inferior. I don't know why I felt ashamed. I don't know why I felt any of those things at 3 years old. But that was the way that I felt. I have some things that seem to go around amongst alcoholics. I'm half Irish and half Italian. I was raised Catholic, and there seems to be a lot of us in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I also have two brothers and a sister, and to my knowledge, we're all by the same parents, and they're not alcoholic, and I am, and I don't know why I am, and today it's really not important that I know, but it's very important that I know that I am an alcoholic. Growing up as a kid, I was really confused. I was really sensitive. I don't know how many of you are sensitive, but it seemed like I was overly sensitive to everything. I can remember one time I came home and I'd been out playing with this friend of mine, Morris. I was about 5 years old, 6 years old, and I came in and I was crying, and my mother asked me why I was crying. And I said it was because of Morris. And she said, "What happened to him?" And I said, "He's Jewish." She said, "So?" And I said, "But he can't go to heaven." And I think that that's really unfair of God. I can't imagine why. Morris seems like a real nice kid. But I don't know if I was taught that or if somehow I misinterpreted the things that they were saying. But as a kid, the kind of God that I had this idea that God rode around on a cloud. And he knew everything. Saw everything, and it seemed like everything was a sin. And the Catholics, they have it very well organized, okay? They have it broken into categories so you can know what degree you are. It's either a mortal sin, a venial sin, or a sacrilege. And the bad part about that is that you don't really have to do any of those things. All you have to do is think them. You ever tried not to think about something? If you're anything like me, by the time I got to about 12 or 13 years old, I said, "Screw it, if I'm going to get docked for it, I'm going to do it." You know. I had this idea of God that he just rode around up there and he kept the track. He had a chalkboard of some kind and he kept track of all your sins, and then sooner or later, if they built up to be too many, just drew a line through you and that was the end of it. But I never knew anything about a God of love or forgiveness or mercy or any of those things. I don't remember that when I was a kid, and I'm sure they must have said it. I really am, because I've gone back to church in recent years and they don't talk like that, so it must have been maybe my conception of what it was that they were saying. But that was the kind of God that I knew about. When, as a kid, I would try really hard to belong. Because I was so afraid that people wouldn't accept me, I would go to any lengths to prove that it was okay for me to be there. And in the beginning, that was pretty innocent because it was baseball or football or basketball or sports of some kind. And I would always be on the team. But I had to try so hard. I mean, when I played baseball, I know I played 10 times harder than anybody else on the whole team because I wanted to be part of it. I wanted to fit in. Every time I showed up for a game, I thought the coach was going to look at me and say, you know, you're not starting today. Because I never felt like I was good enough. Now, I don't know what caused those feelings. I don't know what I could have done that made me so bad at that age that I could have had that type of thoughts and emotions. But I live with that every single day. Childhood for me was punishment. I didn't want to go to school. When I went to school, I had to go be around all those people, and I didn't want to be around those people. I didn't think they liked me. And so it was always difficult. By the time I was about 10 years old, 11 years old, my family had moved around a lot. We were rich at times, poor at times. At times we were very rich. At times we were very poor. This was not one of the better times. And we had moved into a neighborhood that was pretty unique. It was the middle of the school year. I was in the sixth grade, and I was going to school. And when I got there to the street corner, across the street from the school, all the guys were out standing on the street corner with cigarettes hanging out of the side of their mouth, talking garbage, ditching school, fights. I mean, it was tough. And I thought, oh my God, what have I got into here? I had never been around anything like that before. I mean, I just came from a neighborhood that, I mean, all you did was play sports and do different things like that, but I had never even been around a tough neighborhood before. And I wasn't there maybe a month before I figured things out. See, if you got, up till that time, I always got A's and B's in school. I never really even had to read or try. I always got A's and B's. But, you know, if you got A's and B's, you got beat up after school. Okay? It doesn't pay to be smart. And I decided that, you know, being my size, I'm not real big. And I was even smaller then. And I thought, well, it'd be better if you could be the one hitting somebody else rather than the one being hit. And so I decided I would get in with this gang of guys and you know, I would be cool and I would be tough. And that was kind of like the beginning of the end for me. And it all started with smoking cigarettes. That was the first thing. I hated them in the beginning and haven't been able to give them up yet. But I started with that, and then it was the summer between the sixth and seventh grade. The thing to do was to go over to a friend of mine's house. His older brother would go down to the liquor store and buy us gallons of Red Mountain Vin Rosé or quarts of Country Club beer, and we'd get drunk, and we'd go down to this roller skating rink in my neighborhood, and we'd get in fights with guys from other neighborhoods. And I don't know what happened to other people when they drank alcohol, but I know what happened to me. Instead of feeling inferior and insecure and guilty and ashamed and all the horrible things and being on edge all the time with a knot in your gut all the time, all of a sudden I drank alcohol and I could shut out the whole world. I could make everything and everyone go away. Nothing mattered. It relieved all will to care. It was like a magic thing. I could take a switch, turn a switch, and it made everything okay. I didn't become happy and joyous and contented and want to go party. I could go sit down in an alley all by myself with a bottle of Red Mountain wine and be fine. The party was right there because it was in that bottle of wine, because it gave me a feeling, the closest thing to peace that I had ever had. It made everything okay. All I had to do was drink, and I could shut everything and everyone out. In the beginning, I couldn't do that every day. I did it on the weekends. I probably kept that up for the better part of a year and before it got to be more. And then the thing to do wasn't just drinking wine. They were smoking a little non-habit-forming weed with it. I started smoking pot on a daily basis in junior high school. I got to be, I mean, this sounds silly. I say it and it sounds silly and I laugh about it today, but it really wasn't funny then. I can remember in the seventh and eighth grade getting up in the morning, and I would put a towel down by the door in the bathroom upstairs so that nothing, none of the odors could get out of the bathroom. And I would go stand in the shower and I'd turn the water down real low and stand in there and smoke a joint in the shower. Because, you see, I didn't want to go out my door unless I had that feeling. Because the only thing that made me feel like I was a part of or made life tolerable to me was getting high, drinking or taking drugs. After a short while, the thing to do wasn't to just drink wine and smoke pot. They were taking pills with it. I adapted to that very quickly. Although I was kind of scared of pills at first, because a lady that I had known in my neighborhood had taken an overdose of them and died. So I knew that these were serious. And so when all my other partners started taking pills, I held out for a while. I probably waited 3 or 4 weeks before I decided to try them. And when I did decide to try them, we had gone out and I took 5 Seconals or Reds or whatever you want to call them. And in the anticipation that I might like them, I had purchased some extras. And we got pulled over by the police. And back then, it wasn't fashionable to be arrested for possession of dangerous drugs. So I thought, well, the best thing to do would be to swallow them all. And I did. And I really don't remember anything after that. The next thing that I remembered was I came to in my own bed. And I thought, well, that wasn't so bad. Nothing happened. It was no big deal. Until I found out that 2 days had gone by. And I didn't know what had happened during those 2 days. I don't know if someone took me home right after that. I don't know if I was out functioning for 2 days. Because later on, and I could have been out there for 2 days, I know. Because one time, I remember walking down a street, and I had an RC Cola. And I had a pocket full of pills. And I was going to go to Bob's Big Boy and get a hamburger. And I swallowed some of these pills, drank them down with this RC Cola, and the next thing that I remembered, it was 3 weeks later. And I had been out and about, because at different areas of Southern California, they found different articles that belonged to me, so I had to have been out there somewhere. And I remember none of it. I don't remember a thing about it, other than 3 weeks had gone by before I... And they found my wallet in Orange County someplace and told me I beat up somebody in Compton. And I'm thinking, you know, I don't even remember any of it. So I know that it was possible that I was out functioning during those 2 days. I wish I could tell you that I had a family that didn't care about me, but that really wasn't the case in my situation. My mother weighs about 85 pounds and black hair and brown eyes, a little Italian lady. And she loved me more than anything. She would do anything. My dad had left at that time, and my mom would work 18 hours a day cleaning apartments so that she'd have enough money for, you know, to put a roof over our head, to buy me clothes, and to do different things. And, I mean, she would do anything. And I used to get arrested a lot. I went to jail a lot. I was never... You know, a lot of times people stand up here and tell you this story and you think, well, they were probably really cool out there or something. You get this warped image of people because they're standing up here. The fact is, I was never really very cool. I really wasn't. I got loaded all the time. That's what I did. Way beyond. I wanted it all. When I got loaded, if I could still think, if I could talk, I wasn't loaded enough. And if there was any more pot to smoke, if there was anything left to drink, if there was anything left to take, I took it because I hadn't quite got there yet, but I could just see it was within reach. I knew that just a little bit more, and I'm going to reach this point where everything just goes away. And if I'm still thinking, and I have the ability to think that, I haven't quite got there yet. So being in that condition most of the time, I was really easy to arrest. About the most resistance I ever put up was verbal. And when I was taking drugs or drinking, I had a rotten mouth, and I would say things to police officers that would irritate them, you know, regarding their ancestry and things like that. And then all that really did was cause me to get beat up that much worse. But I can remember my mother always coming down to try to get me out of jail, sometimes getting me out, sometimes not being able to get me out. And I can remember always looking at her, and she would be standing there, and she'd be crying. She'd say, why? Why? Why do you do this? This isn't like you, Alan. This isn't you. What's happened to you? And you know, the truth is that I never wanted to be any of the things I was. Under the influence of drugs and under the influence of alcohol, I did a lot of things that I wish I could go and take back. But I can't. I can't take back one thing. I know that today. Back then, I didn't know that. Back then, the guilt and the shame, it was like every day, the problems became greater and the problems became greater and the problems became greater. So the more you drank and the more you took and the more you drank and the more you took, till you just... It just never, it was an never-ending cycle. Never, the only thing that would ever break that cycle for me would be when I would go to jail. And I know that it was God watching out for me, being merciful to get me arrested. I really believe that, because otherwise I probably would have been dead. I would have been dead many, many times. I finally got thrown out of, I had really didn't attend school a lot after the ninth grade. In the tenth grade, I showed up for one half of a third period class in the tenth grade. 3 months after school had started. And the teacher asked me where I had been. I didn't like his tone, so I left. And they put me in a continuation school, and then they threw me out of the continuation school, and after that, I didn't have anything to restrict my activities, and I would just go out and stay out on the streets and get loaded all the time. About that time, I was introduced to another drug. I started shooting heroin along with taking pills and drinking wine and smoking pot, anything else that was there, because I just wanted out. All I wanted was out. Just show me the way out, let me check out, and that'll be fine. And I did a lot of things out there that I didn't want to do. And I was afraid all the time. At 16 years old, I can remember shooting heroin, taking pills, drinking, and smoking pot, and not being able to go to sleep at night. Or remember to getting to a point where you were taking 8 or 10 reds right before you went to bed, so that when you woke up in the morning, you'd already be loaded. Because I didn't even want to spend that 20-minute time frame from the time that I woke up if I had to take those pills and wait for that feeling. I didn't want to have any gap in there, because during that time, it was a madness, because I had to see who I was and what I was. And I didn't like anything about it. I didn't feel very cool. I can remember sleeping with my arms underneath the pillow so that if my mother came into the room that she wouldn't see my arms. And I remember coming to one morning and opening up one eye and seeing my mother standing over my bed, and I realized my left arm was hanging off of the bed, and I probably had 60 or 70 fresh needle marks in my left arm. And I can remember her standing there looking down at my arm and just shaking her head and crying. And I can remember closing my eye again real fast, like I didn't wake up. I didn't want to be confronted with it, because I didn't. That's not what I wanted to be. I never set out to do any of the things that I did. All I know is from the day that I was born, I had this desperation inside. I hurt inside from the day that I was born, and the only thing that made that hurt go away at all was when I drank alcohol or I put something inside me. And the more I drank and the more that I took, the more things that I did that made me hurt that much worse, and the more I had to take. And it was just a cycle, and it doesn't end. There's no break in it. Finally, I got arrested. I had to spend some time in jail. And this time I stayed in for like 3 or 4 months. And during that 3 or 4 months, I decided that this time when I get out, it's going to be different. This time when I get out, I'm not going back over to that neighborhood anymore. I'm not going around those people. I have a friend here. And I made a lot of promises to people. Promises that I really believed too, because I didn't want to live the way I was living. I was tired of going back and forth to jail. I got out at 9 o'clock in the morning. I got home at about 9:35, 9:40. I walked in my mother's apartment. I opened the door of the refrigerator, and there were 2 six-packs of beer in there. And I don't know about any of you. A lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous don't like to cop to this, even if they have it. But I used to have voices that talked to me. I used to have voices that talked to me, and they've been talking to me since I was a little kid. They told me that I was different, that I wasn't as good as. Oh, screw it. Why not just go get loaded? You'll never make it anyway. But see, when you have your defenses up, they have to get a little bit more clever. Okay? So I looked at these 2 6-packs of beer in there, and the little voice said, "You know, Alan, you spent all that time locked up inside that institution. Everyone drinks beer. Certainly a few beers wouldn't hurt you. You don't have to start taking drugs again." And I thought, well, you know, that makes a certain degree of sense. And so I had a few beers. A little while later, a guy came by and lit up a joint, and he handed it to me, and I looked at it. Well, the voice said, "Well, you know, Alan, it's not like it's drugs or anything. You know, it's non-habit forming. Everybody smokes pot. You don't have to start taking drugs again." So we smoked a little pot and decided to go shoot pool. Got to the pool hall, and the manager of the pool hall came out, and he set down a 5 reds, and the cocktail waitress set down a pitcher of beer, and he said, "Welcome home, brother." And he walked away. And I looked over there, and I saw those pills, and the voice said, "You don't have to take all 5. You can just take 2. And I took 2, and then about a half an hour later, I said, "Oh, screw it," and took the other 3. And went to another guy's house and repeated the same scenario with heroin. And that was a one-day deal. From 9 o'clock in the morning to 6 or 7 o'clock at night, I had done everything that there was to do. And it was all over again. I stayed out for 49 days. And it was a 49 days of total, total, total madness. Because I couldn't make it go away anymore. And I don't know how many of you have ever reached that point. I think a lot of us have. But I couldn't shut it out anymore. No matter what I did, it wouldn't all go away anymore. And it was like I was desperate. No matter how much I took and no matter how much I drank, it wasn't, and I couldn't even go to sleep anymore. And finally, the little voice gave me the answer to the whole thing. It was Christmas Eve, and the little voice said, "You know, Alan, all you're going to do, you're just going to keep on doing just exactly what you're doing. You know you're going to get a parole violation. They're going to send you back to an institution again. Is it worth it? Are you really happy? Do you really think you'll ever have a good life or ever be anything? No, you won't. So why not just check out? What you want is peace, and there's peace in dying." So I went out and took an intentional overdose of heroin. I came to in a bathtub filled with ice cubes and cold water and guys shooting milk and salt in my veins 3.5 hours later. And I remember coming to and being disappointed because I wanted out. I wanted to end it. I didn't like life. There was no hope in my life. I had lost sight of any dream of it being any different than just that. All I did was get loaded, get in trouble, and go to jail. That was my whole life. And I was tired of it. And I wasn't cool. I was afraid all the time. I was around people who murdered people. I couldn't have murdered anybody if I had to. I had friends, they all carried guns, they'd go do armed robberies. And they'd say, "Come on." And there was no way I would go do an armed robbery. Because I knew I'd walk in there, and I'd hold out a gun, and I'd say, "Stick him up." And the guy would reach under the counter and get a gun. And then I was going to have to make a decision. Do I shoot the guy and go spend the rest of my life locked up, or do I just stand there and let him shoot me? And I thought, that's not a good deal. I mean, that's a horrible, but neither decision do you win. So what I did out on the streets, mostly, was talk people out of their money. They went and did the robberies, they went and did the burglaries, and they did all those sorts of things, and then I kind of manipulated things a little bit to end up with money. Just enough to get by. I was never big time, I just wanted to get high. During this 49 days, I was introduced to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in kind of a haphazard way, which is the way most of us get here, but a member of Alcoholics Anonymous moved into the apartment across from my mother. He and his wife, when they got married, moved in there, and my mother got talking with his wife and to tell this lady about her son who had just got out of an institution, who's an alcoholic and a drug addict and all these things, and this lady told my mother about her husband, that he was a convict, He'd been to the penitentiaries, ex-drug addict, alcoholic, and he had been sober for, I guess, 7 or 8 years at the time. And they got it all cooked up that I would go over and talk to him and get saved. And my mother came in and told me this story about this man, and he had done all these things, and he was a drug dealer and a pimp and a this and a that, and he was in San Quentin and Folsom and Tehachapi and Chino and all these institutions, and now he's been sober for 7 or 8 years. And I laughed. I thought it was hilarious. I mean, I felt bad for my mom, really, because she was so naive. Because nobody who's done those types of things ever changes. You see, I had never seen anybody who had grown up and done those types of things ever change. I went over, under duress, I went over to see the guy one time. He looked at me, he said, "Are you willing to do anything to stay sober?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Okay, looking the way you look, it's inevitable. You have to get arrested pretty soon. So when they arrest you and send you wherever they're going to send you, you write a letter and I'll come visit you." And I got up and walked out with my first resentment before I knew what a resentment was. I thought, God, what a horrible thing. I mean, we even junkies have feelings. I mean, what does he mean I looked bad? I thought I was cool. I was about 5'7", 115 pounds, white as a sheet, big dark circles around my eyes. I had on my best pair of khakis and sandals. I thought I was really downtown. A couple weeks after that, I was arrested. And I was sent out to an institution in Chino by the name of YTS. And after I was out there for about 90 days, I remembered this guy. And I had started to go to different programs. You see, I wanted a way out. Because I would lay there at night on my bunk and I would stare at the wall. And I'd see the shadows of the bars and the orange nightlight that you can't turn out. And I'd ask myself, where's it all going to end? Where does this thing end at? I mean, I know where it ended for a lot of my friends. Dead by overdose. Dead shot down in armed robberies. Dead stabbed to death in an institution over a bag of potato chips. And I was terrified, you see, because when I was in jail, I had to be cool, and I had to be tough, and I had to be crazy, and I had to be violent, and I wasn't loaded most of the time. I was loaded some of the time, but not most of the time. And I didn't want to go on like that. And I knew the minute that they let me out, I just did the same thing, and the minute I did that thing, they locked me up for it. And it was like a never-ending thing. And I started to investigate all these different programs, and then I remembered this man. I thought, well, maybe there really is something to this. And I wrote a letter, and the following Saturday morning, as soon as visiting hours opened, he was there to visit me. And he came in and he told me about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I started attending AA meetings inside that institution. And I was cool. I didn't want to believe these guys at first because, I mean, you know, they told, I mean, the first panel chairman that came in there, he was probably 23 years old and said that he hadn't drank or taken any drugs in 3 years. And, I mean, I just really had a hard time with that. I could not even conceive of going for a year, a day, or 3 weeks without doing something. Much less going for any 3 years. But they kept telling me that the answer is in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you want to find this thing, if you want to find a way to live out there, to have the kind of life that you always wanted in your heart, to find a way that you don't have to have somebody ring bells to tell you when you can get out of your cell in the morning anymore, and you want to have some kind of a life, the way you're going to find that is you're going to work the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And one night in there, I heard that, and I went back to my cell, and I decided that that night I was going to work the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was motivated. I never want to come back to jail again. If I have to work these steps, I want to work them tonight. I want the results. And much like the speaker said last night, in step one, two, and three, there really wasn't a horrendous amount required of me. I didn't have to put a great deal of effort into step one, two, and three, although I had a few reservations in there. One, I didn't really believe I was an alcoholic. See, my dad was an alcoholic, and I didn't want to be an alcoholic. I thought maybe being a junkie had some slight status above being a wino. Okay? Now, if you'll notice, when I introduced myself, I said, my name's Alan and I'm an alcoholic. I didn't say, my name's Alan and I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict and anything else. I said, my name's Alan and I'm an alcoholic. Why? Because I believe, say that I am afflicted with the disease of alcoholism covers a myriad of problems. My problems are much more widespread than... But back then, I couldn't bring myself to say that I was an alcoholic. But the big problem that I had with the steps, I went over that and I said, well, if I have to say it, even though I don't totally believe it, I will do that if that's what it takes to get the results that I want. But the stumbling block for me was step four. It said in step four, if you can believe this, that I was going to sit down and I was going to write out an inventory and I was going to put down in writing things that I could not admit in my own mind were true. Things that when the thought of them came into my mind would immediately reject it and find some way to shut those experiences out. Because it was like a war on my soul. And this little voice that talked in different words at different times would tell me, Alan, you could never tell anyone that. In step five, it said that I would admit to God, to myself, and to another human being. This, in other words, it inferred that I was going to sit down in front of someone, look them in the eyes, and tell them the nightmares, the horrible things that I had down inside me, the things that I absolutely loathed myself for. And I closed the book. I will die before I will ever do that. Ask some people who have been around Alcoholics Anonymous for any number of years how many people do. Because it's a lot. I got out of that institution after a year. I stayed sober 19 days. After 19 days, I went out and got drunk. I stayed drunk and out on the streets for 3 days. That's how long I lasted, drinking and taking drugs. Now, I was embarrassed to go back and tell all my partners in jail the time before that I'd only stayed out for 49 days. It's difficult to explain three, okay? But during these 3 days, I was a madman. The first day when I got loaded, my mother went over and picked up the telephone and she was going to call my parole officer. And I went over in there and I ripped the phone out of the wall and I threw it through her window. And then I took her by the throat and put her up against the wall and told her if she ever tried to do anything like that again, I would kill her. And I couldn't believe it. I can remember standing there in that living room with her up against the wall and seeing me, and I mean just dropping my hand and turning around and going out the door. And at the end of the 3 days, I was trying to get back in her house. And the police came up and arrested me on her doorstep. Back down to Long Beach City Jail, where I'd been many, many times before. The parole board told me when I left YTS, if I got arrested for littering, I could expect to finish out my expiration date. My expiration date was 2.5 years away. And I was arrested for being a common drunk. I thought, God, 2.5 years for being a common drunk. And it was all over again. I walked out. I thought, maybe this AA thing works. Maybe I really can have some kind of a life. Maybe I don't have to live inside institutions anymore. Maybe, and all the maybes are gone now. Because it's all over again. It lasted 3 days, and it's all gone. I'm going back for another 2.5 years. My own mother told me, Alan, I love you more than anything in the world, but never call here again. Don't come here anymore. Because I can't stand to look at you. I don't have to watch you die. And you had a choice, and this is the choice that you made for you. Laying in a jail cell on a Sunday night, it was the bottom of the pit. Anyone who's been to the bottom of the pit knows the feeling, the desperation to where the total loneliness, there is nothing else on the whole in the whole world but you, and you detest you. And that was that place. And I reached out to God because, you see, I didn't have anything left to turn to. There was nothing else other than God. And when I reached out to God, I wasn't asking him to get me out of jail because I had done that before. It was just that there was nothing else left. And when I did, there was this energy, light, whatever you want to call it, a spiritual experience, if you will, but all of a sudden a feeling of peace came over me, and I didn't hurt inside. And the next day I got up and walked down in front of the judge. And he had no record of me ever being arrested before. Now, you can call that a coincidence, okay? I don't believe in that. I really don't. I have to tell you right now, the only reason that I'm standing here right now is God, okay? That God that I didn't understand when I was a little kid, that I thought was this horrible, vindictive, punishing God, okay? I found out that isn't God at all. And I found out that from the day that I was born, I've had angels walking along this path with me all the way because there's no other explanation for being alive. I don't deserve the life that I have today. It's impossible. You can't go to all those places and do all those things and end up here feeling the way that I feel and feel clean inside and feel peace and happiness and joy and love. How do you do that? How does that happen? I believe it's a miracle. I really believe it's a miracle. And the miracle is called Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's written in a book, and it's got 12 steps. And the miracle takes place for anyone who will work those 12 steps. I got out of jail. At 30 days sober, I did a fourth and fifth step. I got a job, $1.40 an hour in a car wash. I worked at that job for the first year that I was sober. At about a year and a half, I got a job in a commissary, then a machine shop. I was setting the world on fire out there. I'd got up to $2.12 an hour now. I like to remember that. I like to remember that when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I saved for 3 months so that I could buy a nice pair of slacks to wear to meetings because I had one pair of pants. I had some khakis that I wore to work, but I had one pair of pants. I had a sweater that my sponsor donated to me, and that was it. Today I have a nice closet full of clothes. I have a lot of nice things today, but I like to remember where it was I came from. I got very active in Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to a lot of meetings, got involved in a group, continued to work the steps. And after a couple of years, I got involved in sales. And when I got into sales, from the day that I got into sales, I was fairly successful at it. I attribute it to two reasons. One, I believe God gives everybody certain gifts. And I believe sales or marketing or management or motivation, those types of things, just happen to be mine because I've never studied it. The other thing is, I had previous experience. I used to sell a lot of things I didn't have. And when they gave you a card and a phone number and all that, it just lent so much credibility to the whole thing. It really made it easy. I did pretty well at that, and then at about 2 years sober, all of a sudden, they had me going everywhere to speak. You see, I was a real novelty. No, I'm not today. Today I'm 36 years old, but back then I was like 21 years old, and I had 3 years of sobriety, or 2 years, 3 years of sobriety, and there weren't a lot of people in 1972 who had that much time. And so, I mean, they would just call you and they would send you, and I would go speak night after night. I got to the point when I was 4 years sober, there was one time I went 9 nights in a row and had to talk someplace 9 nights in a row. And I lost all concept of reality. All of a sudden, you see, when you're sitting down there and you hear a speaker and you think, oh, what a wonderful story, and that's so great that that happened for them. And you forget that they live out in the world, and I live out in the world just like everybody else does, with all the same problems. And the difference is, when you're talking 9 times in 9 days, you can't go to people and say, you know, I really am feeling kind of insecure and jealous today, and I think I lack faith. You lose perspective of reality, and you sometimes exaggerate your importance in your own mind. And that was something that I had a real problem with. I had got married, and my wife, I'd come home, and she would tell me what she thought, and it wasn't what the people had told me right after I finished talking. But you see, I got all involved in the activities of Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to a lot of meetings. But I did not continue to work the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And there's 2 steps I want to bring up right now. Number one, I did not develop a relationship with a power greater than myself. I mentioned God frequently. I prayed to God frequently. But I did not develop a relationship with a power greater than myself. I did not work step 10. I did not sit down and review my day to see where I was jealous or insecure or fearful, where I lacked faith, where I might have infringed on another person's rights, where I needed to make amends. I didn't do that. I didn't seek through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God on a daily basis. The extent of my prayers were I would get in bed and I would say, hey, thanks a lot for this day. Let's do this thing again tomorrow. And that would be about it. I spent more time talking to somebody over a cup of coffee than I spent trying to learn about or get close to God. All of a sudden, I became as obsessed with success as I had ever been with drugs. I thought if I had enough, it would make the whole world okay. You see, because my insides were not okay. And if I could get enough, everything would be all right. If I could just get enough, if I could get in enough things and had enough money and enough power, that I would be in great shape. And I set out to get that. I wanted success, and I wanted it all. I wanted it the way I used drugs and the way that I drank alcohol. That's the kind of success I wanted. I can remember 6 months after starting a company, getting a paycheck that was more than I made for 1 month, more than I made in the first 5 years of sobriety, and looking at that check and saying, this is peanuts. I can't live on this. This wouldn't even fuel a Learjet, much less buy one. But I was sick. But I was sick and I was sober. After 7.5 years, this little voice seemed like the sicker I got, the more this little voice started to come back and talk to me. And it's really stressful out there when you're trying to make $30 million. You think I'm kidding? I'm serious. It's tough. Because I didn't even want $1 million. $1 million, really, I didn't even count that as being that successful. But the little voice told me that, you know, I'm probably not really an alcoholic. That basically anyone who would have grown up in that type of a neighborhood, in that environment, would have done a lot of the same things that I did. And now I'm 25 years old, 26 years old. I'm successful. I'm president of a company. Been sober all these years. I've really got my life together. Everything's really moving my way. Certainly I could probably just drink a little wine with dinner. Maybe smoke a joint from time to time, you know, just to take the edge off, because, I mean, I was under a great deal of stress. And finally, I did. And I started smoking pot. 2 weeks later, I started to drink. And I drank and I smoked pot every single day for a year and a half. All the time. I functioned for a long time out there drinking and smoking pot. I smoked pot from the time I got out of bed to the time I went to bed. I smoked it before business meetings. I smoked it all the time. Okay? I can remember one time, it was one time that I can remember something funny, because it was tragic. That I was out for a little over 2 years, and it was tragic because I tried many, many times to come back to Alcoholics Anonymous. One time I had gone to lunch, and I decided to smoke some pot on the way to lunch, and I'd had a few drinks. And I don't know if you've ever had that pot that you just can't stop laughing. And I very seldom ever had it. But, I mean, it was one of these kinds. I mean, it's that just no matter what people said or did, it seemed funny. And I got back to my office, and my secretary said, "Alan, did you forget about that meeting?" And I said, "What meeting?" And she says, "You have to be at Long Beach City Hall." I thought, oh, no. And I had a meeting with the president of Southern California Gas and Edison, city mayor, city attorney. I mean, this was all big shots. State senator. And I sat there at this table, and I was loaded. And, I mean, they're real, you know, it's one of these real cold rooms, you know, with the paneling and the light and the long table. Looks like a board table. And, I mean, I'm sitting there biting my hand because I'm trying not to laugh because it all seems so damn funny. God, what am I doing here? But I tried to come back to Alcoholics Anonymous many, many times and could not get back. After a year and a half, I was introduced to another drug that I had never taken before. Because it wasn't around. Not because I didn't have a desire to. It's just that no one had ever offered it to me before. And the first time they offered it to me, I took it. And it's called cocaine. Bad drug for an alcoholic. See, I mean, you drink enough, you will either pass out or die. You take enough pills, you will either pass out or die. You take cocaine and you don't have to stop. You just keep going, day in and day out. And you don't eat and you don't sleep and you don't do anything. You just snort cocaine and drink scotch. And that was the combination that I loved. And I was already drinking before I started doing the cocaine. I was already drinking a quart of scotch a day. When I started doing the cocaine, I started drinking literally 2 to 3 quarts of Johnny Walker scotch a day. It was the only thing that seemed to quench my thirst when I did cocaine. And I would play a balancing act. If I got too drunk, I would do a little bit more cocaine, and then I would be okay. And if I got a little too like this, I would drink a little bit more scotch, and I would just go for days. Day in and day out and day in and day out and day in and day out. And I did this for about 30, 40 days. And I couldn't snort any more cocaine. I could not get it to go up my nose any longer. Little voice said, "I'll bet you could shoot this stuff." And I started shooting cocaine. And for the last 4 to 6 months, prior to coming back to Alcoholics Anonymous, I drank and shot cocaine. I would go from a short time of 3 days to a long time of 9 days, where I would lock myself up in my place, and I would shoot cocaine every 5 to 10 minutes, and drink scotch, and smoke pot, listen to Bob Dylan's Street Legal. That'll give you the idea of the frame of mind I was in. Edgar Allan Poe's story seemed lightweight to compare to where I was. Pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization would have been a major step forward. I was as sick as I could imagine, and I couldn't stop. I would sit down and I would start off and I'd have this mountain of drugs and all these bottles of scotch and I'd say, I'm never going to run out. I'll never run out. And the next thing I knew, it was days later. And I was sitting down there scraping down a bag or pounding out cottons trying to get just one more. If I could just get high one more time. If I could just have that feeling one more time. And I'd see things crawling over my body, and I got to a point where you feel like you're burning up, and so you finally just go fill up the bathtub with cold water, and you set your syringes and your scotch down along the bathtub, and you just stay in there because you can't leave anyway, because you're afraid to go out of the bathroom, because you don't know what's out there. There's people and things out there that are waiting to get you, and the only room in the whole house that's safe is that bathroom. Now, that sounds crazy, and it is, but that's the way that it was. I can remember running out of cigarettes, and calling somebody and paying him a gram of cocaine to drive to my house to get the cigarettes out of my car and bring them up to my apartment. Because I couldn't go outside because they were waiting. Okay? And they were going to get me. And then at the end of one of these runs, I had to shut it all off. I can't go any further. And I'd keep a gallon of wine in the refrigerator and I'd go guzzle down the wine and then I'd be able to pass out. And when I woke up, I would get up and I would shave and I'd shower and I'd put on a suit. And I would go to my office because I'm going to change. I'm not going to do this again. I can't do this anymore. I can't go any further. I'm going to go to my office. I'm going to get everything straightened out. You know, I'm going to go back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to get sober. And I would last for maybe 12 or 14 hours before the insanity came back and I would just go back out and start it all over again to where I couldn't do it any longer. I attended a Southern California convention. And I remember standing there in the back of the room, and I looked out across this room, and there was probably 5,000 or 6,000 people in this room, and I can remember standing at the back and just sobbing. Because all I wanted to be was a member of AA, and I was never going to get to be a member of AA again. You see, because I couldn't stop, and I knew I was going to die, and everything was leaving me. I had no money left, my business, everything. The whole world has fallen apart, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, and everything. See, I couldn't even turn to God anymore. I couldn't turn to God because what the hell would God want to do with me? You see, because I know God has bailed me out every day of my life. God has been there, and no one deserves any more breaks than what God has given to me. And look at what I've done with myself. I lay in bathtubs and shoot cocaine as sick as can be. So what would give me the right to even turn to God, to pray to God anymore? God wouldn't even spit on me. And I tried one last time to get sober, and I could not. So I decided it's time to check out one last time, and this time I'm going to make sure I go. And I went out, and I put a gram of pure cocaine in one syringe and a spoon of heroin in another syringe and tied off both of my arms at the same time and shot the cocaine in one arm, the heroin in the other arm, and took a gulp off a water glass full of scotch. And when I fell face forward on the bed, it was just like a jet engine attached to each ear. And the next thing that I knew, I looked down and I saw me laying there face down. And I remember saying, well, Alan, you finally did it. You're 27 years old. You finally killed yourself. And I came to the next afternoon. And I walked around and asked people for 3 days if I was alive because I knew that I had died and gone to hell. I knew that that was just my spirit, and my spirit was going to be locked into this guilt and shame and torment and fear and all these different things from now into eternity, and that's what it's all about. Little by little, I started getting better. I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was a very humbling experience for me. Stand up as a newcomer. After being a big-time speaker, most of the people that were there, I saw them come to Alcoholics Anonymous. But I just kept doing it and kept doing it and kept doing it. I lost everything. At 90 days sober this time, I borrowed $250 so that I could buy a car so that I could take a job, making less money than when I paid my secretary the year before. Was that hard to do? You bet. Was I just thrilled to death to just have that opportunity? Not on your life. Okay? It hurt. It was really hard. It was really hard because I had to break down every bit of ego and pride that was in me, and there was a lot. I had to throw it all away. I can remember sitting, getting interviewed. I mean, I'll give you an idea how sick I was. I can remember going to an interview. I had no money. I was living with my mother and father. I had just borrowed the $250 so that I could buy a car so that in case I got a job, I'd have some way to get there. And I went out on an interview, and I sat there, and I was talking to this guy who was vice president of sales for this fairly large company. And I like to know who it is I'm thinking about working for. And so, I had given him some questions in regards to sales and marketing and business, and the guy really wasn't too bright. And then it started bothering me that, I couldn't work for someone that wasn't any smarter than this. And about halfway through the interview, I stood up and started to walk out. And he says, excuse me, where are you going? And I said, well, I'm leaving now. And he says, well, the interview isn't over. I said, no, really it is. I said, I couldn't possibly work for you. Well, why not? And I said, because I know too much more than you do. And I would really find it difficult to work for somebody unless they knew more and could teach me something. But I mean, that was how... And then afterwards, I went and told this girl that I was going out with at the time, and she said, you're a jerk, Alan. I said, excuse me? She says, you need a job. You don't have any food. He has a job. He has a car. He has some place to live. You don't have anything. So all that great intelligence that you have isn't doing you a damn bit of good right now. And she was right. I finally did get a job. And little by little, things got better. The obsession to drink slowly went away. And I want to say that for the new people here tonight. For the first 6 months that I was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, which will be 9 years, November the 3rd. For the first 6 months, I had a desire to take drugs and to drink every day. Every day I had a desire to drink. And I found out who the winners are in Alcoholics Anonymous. I found out that if you want to be a winner, when the day comes that there seems to be no valid reason not to get drunk, you just don't do it anyway. Now that may sound too simple, but at no price do you drink alcohol. At no price do you put anything in you, because it's not going to make it any better. And fortunately, I had reached that point where I knew nothing is going to make it better. So I'm just going to feel this pain. I'm going to feel the pain. I'm going to experience all the different things that I have inside me. At about 3 years sober this time, I had become moderately successful again. I had worked my way up in a very large company. I was vice president, national sales manager of the company. It was a fairly prestigious job. And I felt empty. I went to meetings. I talked. I sponsored people. I did all those things. And I had this emptiness inside of me. I felt a lot the same way that I felt at 7.5 years sober the first time. And all of a sudden, there was a voice. And it was a voice that had been with me my whole life. But it wasn't the voice that talked to me in my head. It was the voice that always wanted me to do the right thing. It was the voice that was down in my heart. It was the voice that when I did something wrong, reprimanded me. And when I did something right, just got a certain glow or just vibrated a good feeling over my whole body. And this voice said, Alan, you better find me, and you better find me now. And I'm God. Where do you look for God?
I didn't know how to get up on the clouds. You see, because that's the God that I had, was the God that I rode around on the clouds with the chalkboard. You see, because I had never done anything to find out anything new about God. And all of a sudden, I became absolutely obsessed with finding God. I have to find a relationship. I knew that I am either going to find a relationship with a power greater than myself, or I'm going to die sober. Sober. And I started doing a lot of reading. I started reading all kinds of different books. Anything I could get my hands on about religion, spirituality, metaphysics, you name it, I read it. I probably read 1,500 books in the last 6 years. Trying to find God. So I got to find Him. Because that's the source. That's the whole thing. That's what makes it all work for me. And either I'm going to have that or I'm going to die. And I don't want to die. And when I started reading all these different things, everything said something different. How many gods are there? Because everything had a different definition to it. Everything had a different explanation to it. And I can remember coming home one night. And I was so frustrated. Because I thought, I'm trying to find God. I can't even find God because I'm hearing so many different things. Who is He really? What is He really? I mean, what is this whole deal all about? And I did what I know today to be probably the best decision that I ever made in my entire life. And that is, I went in and I got down on my knees. And I told God that I was looking for Him. And that I wanted to find the truth. And I wouldn't settle for anything short of the truth. And that I'll do anything that I have to do. And I'll be anything that I have to be. And I don't care how unpopular that truth is. I would rather have an unpopular truth than a very popular lie. And little by little by little by little by little, I would pray and I would meditate and I would pray and I would meditate and I would read and I would read and little by little developing a relationship with a power greater than myself. And I've got to tell you that the thing, what that did for me is fulfill the promises that are written in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. You see, the book of Alcoholics Anonymous makes certain promises. It says that we're going to find peace and joy and happiness, that our darkest past will become our greatest asset, that we'll intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle us, we'll realize that God is doing for us what we could never do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? No. They're being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly, but they'll always materialize if we work for them. If we work for them. And the thing is, I don't want to be guilty of not working for them. You see, because for one instant of that feeling of joy, of peace, of happiness, to feel clean inside, to be a useful member of the world, it's the greatest thing that's ever happened to me. And yet I still have to live out there every single day. And I'll tell you, the world out there isn't getting any better. It's not getting any better. It seems to get worse on a daily basis. And the thing that helps me to keep that sanity is coming here. It's that God and coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. There's hope here for the people that are new. You probably came here like I did. All I wanted when I came here is just help me to stop drinking and using drugs. But what I found was life. Real life. Not just a way not to drink alcohol. But I found love. I found peace. I found understanding. And I found God. And in the end of this search for God, I realized that for many years, I'd been standing in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. At the end of the meeting, we all stand up and we hold hands. And the first two words we say are, "Our Father." And I found out that's who God is. And I found out that that little voice that's been down in my heart all my life, that always urged me to do the right thing, that always pained me terribly when I did something wrong, was God. And I've got to tell you, I'm accused of being sadistic at times, because a lot of my close friends come to me and they're really in a great deal of pain. And they say, "God, I'm just hurting so bad." I said, "That's great." "What do you mean that's great?" I said, "Well, it's proof God loves you." He said, "Excuse me, Alan, I really have a hard time with that. But I really believe that, because I believe that the conscience that I had my whole life, the pain of doing the things wrong, I believe that that was a loving father just correcting his son, just trying to bring him back into line so that he could find real life, so he could find happiness in it, so that he could share it with others. And I believe that that was the purpose. And I believe if you don't feel pain when you do something really bad to somebody else, there's something wrong. And it seems like if I'm in pain, there's two ways of getting out. I used to believe that I could drink alcohol or take drugs and forget about pain, but really the pain never went away. Today I find that when I make peace with my God over whatever it is that pains me, all of a sudden the pain has gone away, and all of a sudden there's that feeling of happiness and peace and joy that comes back. But that's up to me, and it's something that I have to work at. I have to, on a daily basis, work step 10 and work step 11. And what I'm saying, if you're new here tonight, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous promises you that you're going to find happiness and peace and joy and all those types of things, that your life will change. Don't settle for anything short of that. You don't have to. If you're sitting out there tonight and you have 1 week, 1 year, 20 years, or 40 years, and you haven't found what is written in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous that is absolutely promised, it says it will happen for us if we will work for it. And I'm here to tell you that a lot of that is unlocked in step 10 and step 11. And those are two steps that people don't talk a lot about here. But it will happen, and it'll happen for you too. Thank you.